A couple of hikers are blazing a new trail through our region on a passage that spans 1,800 miles. I'm Jennifer Sveta-Jordan. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Today we check in with the first through hikers on the Great Eastern Trail.
And here we've had to rely a lot more on luck and friends along the way.
Plus, the bat population continues to face challenges, with thousands of bats found dead from white nose syndrome. On the other end of the spectrum, many say there are too many deer in our woods. We'll consider the environmental impacts. All this, plus a man who's a fifth-generation basket weaver. Please stay tuned to the Allegheny Front. The first hikers traveling all the way through an 1,800-mile trail called the Great Eastern Trail are now making their way through West Virginia toward Pennsylvania. The entire trail runs through 9 states, from Alabama all the way to New York. The hikers are Bart Houck and Joanna Swanson. I called while they were taking a break from the trail. First on the line is Joe. Thanks for speaking with me.
Oh, for sure. We really love getting the word out about the trail.
Yeah, let me in on some more about the trail itself, because I think people might be surprised to hear this Great Eastern Trail is running through their state. This isn't just something that popped up overnight, but it's, if, as I understand it, a connection of existing trails?
Yes. So the Great Eastern Trail, the idea of it has been around since the very first thru-hiker of the Appalachian Trail, but it hasn't really happened until the last few years. In 2007, some folks got together and looked at maps of existing trails and realized that with only a little work connecting the trails, we could have another long-distance trail in the east.
And you actually did the Appalachian Trail, so how does this compare?
They're very different. Right now, this trail is right around 70% complete, and so we spend a lot more time figuring out how to connect the dots on this trail, whereas on the Appalachian Trail, you can just get on and cruise. There are a lot of services set up for hikers along the way on the AT, and here we've had to rely a lot more on luck and friends along the way. And we've had some amazing luck and some amazing friends.
Is there one story you could pick that stands out?
Oh, yes. In Georgia, I hurt my ankle, and I was limping around and was generally miserable, and we were on a roadwalk, and I collapsed by the side of the road, and I was super upset about everything, and nothing was good. And this guy that lived nearby jumped in his truck and came down, and we started talking to him, and he wanted to make sure we were okay, and I said, yeah, I'm fine, it's just my ankle. And he invited us to sleep in his yard for the night, and he had an old mattress that he dragged out, and we set our tent up on top of it, and he and his wife made hamburgers for us, and we just had a great time, made new friends. And, you know, if I'd chosen any other place to plop down and rest my ankle, it would have been a different day entirely.
Yeah. Although I don't know that everybody thinks that it's generous to have a mattress dragged out in the yard.
You know, it's those small things in life you get excited about.
So tell me about yourself and how you got this gig.
All right. Well, I'm a trail geek. I've been volunteering on trails for a long time. And last year I was the Great Eastern Trail Vista, AmeriCorps Vista, in a little town in West Virginia called Mullins. And I spent a year trying to make the Great Eastern Trail more connected here in southern West Virginia. And, you know, I just had the idea one day that, you know, I could maybe make this happen, actually hike it all. In this area, a lot of people don't realize that the trail exists. And it's hard to get local support for it when people don't see it, you know, actually being used a lot. And so we thought that, you know, one way to get people excited about it is if they could actually see that, yes, people come and they hike this, and this could be a great chance for economic development.
And do you mind turning the phone over to Bart?
Hi.
Hi. I asked Joe a little bit about herself. How about you? How did you come to go on this journey?
Well, as Joe's doing, I'm a volunteer for the local hiking club here in West Virginia. It's TUGANU, which is an acronym for Tug Valley Watershed, Guyandot Watershed, and the New River Watershed, which is where the trail is going to go through. I was just a local volunteer when she came to town because they was going to route this trail outside of West Virginia because of land issues and stuff, and we just didn't want that to happen. and she came down, and a lot of other smart people were involved in getting this trail hikeable through West Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to hand it back over to Joe?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. What's up for this week or tomorrow?
All right, well, tomorrow we're going to be walking on some very old roads, which are no longer really roads. We'll be fording a stream about 7 different times. And then we'll be getting into Pipestem State Park, and we'll be hiking along the Bluestone Turnpike Trail. And we hope that the day after tomorrow we will arrive in Hinton and hopefully stay with someone Bart knows, family. And then we will start heading the trail dips south to Parisburg, Virginia. So we should be there in just a few days, and then we head north again.
I guess it's pretty wonderful.
Life is good. Yeah, I feel really lucky to have this chance, and it'll be a slap in the face when we get back and we have to, you know, start looking for work and come back to reality.
Right.
But
well, thanks very much. That was Joanna Swanson and Bart Houck. They're hikers on the Great Eastern Trail. It's a new trail that runs 1,800 miles. They're going all the way through. They're now in West Virginia on their way to Pennsylvania and eventually on to New York. We'll be checking in with them along the way here on the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. It's time for Wild and Seek, the Allegheny Front series that searches out interesting animals, plants, and habitats in our region to see how our wildlife is faring in a changing environment. Bats are one of the creatures that are not doing too well. Many in our region have been decimated by what's known as white nose syndrome. Almost all of the bats in one of the largest bat caves in Pennsylvania, the abandoned Durham Mine in Bucks County, died recently. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple talks with Greg Turner, a biologist and bat specialist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission.
You've been visiting the caves of hibernating bats throughout the last winter. You found 10,000 bats dead in an abandoned mine called the Durham Mine, just 23 bats alive. That must have been a very difficult scene. Tell me how it unfolded.
Well, this has been occurring since about 2009. The bats actually, for the most part, fly out in the middle of winter and die on the landscape. So going in to the site this year, it was more along the lines of a ghost town.
Was it a surprising discovery?
Unfortunately, no. I've been seeing this occur again and again across the state. Right now, we're looking at about a 98-99% overall decline in our hibernating bats.
So the cause of the bat decline was white nose syndrome, is that right?
That's correct. White nose syndrome is a fungus that came from Europe.
How does white nose syndrome affect the bats and cause their deaths?
Once the bats get the fungus, the infection starts. Somehow this fungus causes the bats to arouse more frequently than they should be. By doing this, they're burning through their fat stores for the winter. They need to hibernate for about 6 months every year. And they have just enough fat to do that.
Is what you found, or I guess what you didn't find, in the Durham Mine consistent with what you found at other sites that you've monitored this winter?
Yes, we're seeing this same severe decline across the entire state. We do have a couple of sites that we have a pretty good solid big brown bat populations, and the big brown bats seem to be doing fairly well.
Which species of bats used to live in the Durham Mine in Bucks County?
5 out of the 6 hibernating species. The only one that was missing was the Indiana bat, which is our federally endangered species. The species that were present were the big brown bat, the little brown bat, the northern long-eared, the pipistrelle, and the small-footed bat.
Are any of those bats that you mentioned on the federal endangered list, or are they protected in Pennsylvania?
The small-footed bat is a state-threatened species and has been for a long time, well over a decade. The pipistrelle, the little brown, and the northern long-eared are proposed for state listing. Small-footed bat, the little brown bat, and the northern long-eared bat are proposed for federally endangered.
Does the information that you gathered this winter give you a better idea of how bats will fare in the future?
Well, what we're trying to look for is whether the disease has bottomed out. We're looking for that indication that we have survivors that are going to start reproducing and producing young that have a resistant trait. We're at that tipping point right now. It looks like there may be a couple sites in New York that have bottomed out and are starting to show some signs of potential increase. In Pennsylvania right now, sites like the Durham Mine that have had white nose syndrome going on its fourth year are actually still declining.
Greg, how will the loss of so many bats affect the ecosystem?
That would take an entire team of folks studying the insect populations to kind of get at that answer. We don't know how losing these top predators of insects are going to change the insect dynamics at this time.
Is there any progress being made in helping bats deal with this disease?
We've tried several treatments in Pennsylvania, in the laboratory, and in the field, and all of those have actually failed. Most of the treatments have actually killed the bats. Really, what it comes down to is trying to prevent the spread of this, and we have not been very successful in that regard either.
Why is that?
It's a very difficult task to keep bats from flying out and leaving the sites and spreading it to other sites.
Is it safe to say that white nose syndrome is the biggest threat to Pennsylvania's cave-dwelling bats?
Oh, by far, this is the biggest threat to all cave bats, yes.
Well, Greg, thanks for talking with me.
Sure.
I've been speaking with Greg Turner, a biologist with the Pennsylvania Game Commission, about his research on the devastating impact of white nose syndrome in Pennsylvania's bats. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapple.
That story was part of our series Wild and Seek, in which we find and profile cool animals, plants, and habitats in our region and consider how these elements of our ecosystem are doing in a changing environment. This coverage is funded by the Richard King Mellon Foundation.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, intern Rachel Grace gets up close and personal with her favorite animal, an endangered red panda.
She looks a lot like a mix between a raccoon and a fox and a bear.
A trip to the zoo later on the Allegheny Front. Please stick around. Now let's take what feels like a step back for a moment to a simpler time. The Allegheny Front's Janelle Pfeiffer introduces us to a traditional white oak basket weaver as he demonstrates his work at a festival. This piece first aired last year and just received award recognition from both the Western Pennsylvania Press Club and the Pennsylvania Associated Press Broadcasters Association.
It's a gray and breezy afternoon in Somerset as Bill Hill props a white oak log on its end and prepares to use a big bladed tool to split the wood and wrench it apart.
So I'm going to see if I can split this, if it's not too heavy.
He takes a wide stance and his knuckles turn a little white.
But I'll continue to lever this wood apart.
White oak has lots of fibers, part of the reason why it's so great for weaving baskets, and also why it can be a bit of a bear to separate.
So you don't have to go to the gym when you're doing this kind of work.
Hill's been working with white oak for 60 years, since he was an 8-year-old kid growing up in Alabama.
I helped my grandpa put seats in 2 rocking chairs for my mother. So that's the first time I actually handled splits and help hold them in place and help weave.
Now even at Mountain Craft Days, a festival celebrating traditional crafts, Hill's seen as a sort of relic. Mark Ware is one of the event organizers.
A lot of basket makers today buy the pre-packaged, machine-made materials. But Bill starts with the tree.
Actually, he starts in the woods, looking for the tree. He wants one without any knots or twisted bark.
You want to search for that tree that where the bark feels kind of crumbly on it, so that tells you that it most likely will be good wood. It's not going to be too brittle.
He finds it, cuts it down, and splits the wood until the pieces are thin enough to weave. Getting slivers as thin as a 16th of an inch is much more delicate work. Hill's now using a small knife blade and peeling the wood apart with his fingers.
And this is a part, too, that while it doesn't look all that difficult, there's a certain feel to it that you get with practice.
It's the same way with weaving. Hill can now recite patterns he's used for years. He talks about the intricacies of making a square basket versus a round one, and of double lashing the handle so it's good and strong.
And then finally I finish it off with the decorative braid here, that's sort of the signature. And then, you know, you have a basket that will last you, well, I've have some 150 years old.
This is worth saying again. He has baskets that are 150 years old. And they aren't sitting in a glass case somewhere either. They're fully functional.
That's what we made the basket for, was for eggs or for picking beans or for gathering berries or corn or a cotton basket, the biggest one that I have there.
Hill doesn't spend all that much time on the farm anymore. Now he lives and works in Munhall, PA. And all this begs the question, where does the tradition go from here? Here's Mark Ware.
Well, historically, it was passed down generation to generation, but in this day and age, it doesn't necessarily follow that anymore.
This is even the case in Hill's family.
I'm the youngest of four boys in my family. I'm the only one that actually started making baskets. My other brothers never took an interest in it.
And this is half the reason Hill's demonstrating today. He's not selling baskets. He's just showing people how to make them. Because ultimately, that's what he wants his audience to do. He says there's still a smattering of people around who've grown up with the trade.
Some in Virginia, some in Florida, some in the Ozarks, some in Tennessee.
But there's not all that many. Still, Hill's confident the tradition won't fade away. So he spends time demonstrating throughout Pennsylvania, a state where white oak trees are among the most common.
So Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania, it's a great place to be. Of course, the name Pennsylvania, Penn's Woods, so it's a great place to have great forests and resources.
Hill may be a man of tradition, but he's not opposed to new tools. Now he's online, using Facebook to reach a new audience. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Janelle Pfeiffer.
And if you're among those who want to keep the tradition going, Bill Hill is offering a basket-making class this spring at the Somerset Historical Center. Please go to our website, AlleghenyFront.org, to learn more. Well, whether you consider white-tailed deer a sweet sign of the pastoral life or a rodent-like pest, the animals have a strong influence on our environment's health. Deer populations are at their highest in decades, and scientists don't foresee them decreasing anytime soon. Al Cambrone is the author of the new book, Deerland, America's Hunt for Ecological Balance and the Essence of Wildness. He joins me on the phone from Wisconsin to discuss how deer affect humans and why a balanced population is beneficial to both man and animal. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
So why don't you start by reading this passage from your book? It's part of a chapter in Deerland that illustrates the environmental impacts of deer overpopulation.
Sure. It's a scene that takes place in a private club whose members had decided they wanted no hunting. This is in the northeastern corner of Wisconsin. They decided that back in the 1920s. At the time, it was a remarkably progressive idea, and they were very excited when they started seeing a few deer. Eventually, as in much of America, they now had a new problem. They had way too many deer. My guide was a botanist, one of the experts on overabundant deer and how they affect the forest ecosystem. His name was Tom Rooney. And in this scene, we're walking through an area. It was very green and beautiful if you didn't know what you were looking at, but there wasn't much moving and wasn't much alive. I called this passage Silent Summer. As we walked farther, Tom pointed out a few more types of plants that, for one reason or another, don't interest deer. Everything else was gone. True, it was green. But there was no cover for small mammals or ground-nesting birds. There was no understory or midstory where other songbirds would be nesting. No grouse, no turkeys, no finches, no warblers, no squirrels, no chipmunks, no nothing. It was a still, humid day in June. Nothing moved, and the forest was strangely silent. Once or twice, I heard a robin off in the distance. That was all.
Wow, that's sort of an eerie image. It reminds me of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, this idea of the forest as silent. Can you explain how deer population size might cause this?
You know, everything's connected. Let me give you an example. I talked with one ecologist who found a strong connection, believe it or not, between deer and caterpillars. Huh. Deer like to attack the same trees as caterpillars for the same reason. Their leaves are more tender and delicious and nutritious than those of many other trees. So deer will eat those first, and if deer eat them when they're just seedlings or saplings, they won't grow into tall trees whose leaves will feed caterpillars. And then those caterpillars, in turn, they would have been eaten by birds that live in the canopy. And so now those birds are gone. And in general, not just in that instance, but more broadly, too many deer, it means fewer songbirds and also fewer types, less diversity of species. One study found that for birds, pens with the most deer, around 65 per square mile, had 37% fewer birds and 27% less bird diversity than some other pens in the same study that had about 10 deer per square mile. And right now, much of America, especially east of the Mississippi, and especially in our suburbs where they sprawl out into the countryside, much of America now has deer densities higher than that 65 per square mile figure.
You say we have 30 million deer, 100 times more than a century ago. How did we get into this situation?
Basically, we overreacted. Going back to the very beginning, we'd almost wiped deer out all across the North American landscape. The harvest for millennia by Native Americans was pretty sustainable. But then, for a couple hundred years, we were killing every deer we could for meat and hides. Settlers moved in. Market hunters made a living hunting deer, just like buffalo or passenger pigeons. And for a while, it looked like deer were headed toward the same fate. It just couldn't last. But then around 1900, we made some changes. There was a turning point. Market hunting became illegal. Hunting became more highly regulated. We've also removed predators from most of the North American landscape. We have sprawling suburbs. We've created a whole new type of habitat that's perfect for deer.
And then what about the way forward? How can this be turned around, if it can?
It's not going to be easy. One thing we can do is encourage hunters to shoot more deer and different deer. A lot of deer hunters still have that old thinking that we should only hunt bucks, and to kill does just isn't right somehow, or it isn't manly. But if we can encourage hunters to shoot more deer and different deer, that will help. And yet a lot of the places where we have too many deer are in suburbs and even in major cities and some of the parks and green spaces. And it's hard to do much hunting there, even if hunters would want to.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me on your show. This was fun.
I've been speaking with Al Cambrone, author of Deerland, America's Hunt for Ecological Balance and the Essence of Wildness. You can find photos of the stark difference between the plant growth of an area where there are deer versus where there are no deer at AlleghenyFront.org, as well as links to Al's work and resources. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. Many of us will only see a Firefox, aka Red Panda, as an icon for a web browser. But checking out the real thing just got a little easier. The Pittsburgh Zoo became one of about 80 zoos to display a red panda. These animals are listed as endangered. Now, the red panda also happens to be the Allegheny Front intern Rachel Grace's favorite animal. So we sent her to the zoo to check it out. She spoke with panda keeper Ray Bamrick.
I haven't seen one of these, actually, ever. She looks a lot like a mix between a raccoon And a fox and a bear?
Taxonomically, scientists have had a very difficult time classifying the red panda. Today, they're classified in their own subfamily. And probably the closest relation would be the panda group, but you're going to have to go back about 10 million years before you find a common ancestor.
So this is kind of a big deal to have the red panda here.
Well, it's the first red panda here at the Pittsburgh Zoo and PPG Aquarium. We have lines on Tuesday during the middle of the week when it's supposed to be a little bit slower. People love the panda. They really identify with her uniqueness, and she's beautiful.
So what are the environmental threats to the red panda in the wild?
The main predator is a snow leopard, and that's why the panda will spend most of its time up in trees and only come down at night when the leopard is less of a threat. Their main threat is humans through habitat loss. They're cutting the forest down. So there are estimated to be about 2,500 red pandas in the wild.
Another threat to the red pandas that they are poached for their beautiful red coat. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Well, they are poached for their fur. As you mentioned, it's very beautiful, and also for their fluffy tail. The main cause is habitat loss, but they are poached as well. The red coat that they have helps them blend in nature to the red mosses in the trees where they live and some of the white lichen. So that helps them blend in. It's sort of a natural camouflage for them. But to us, it's very beautiful.
Can you give a little bit of a background about the red panda, what the habitat is like in, their natural habitat or what they eat?
Red pandas are found in a part of the world that's very cool. They're from the Himalayan mountain areas, central China, Nepal, those areas. They live in elevations over 6,000 feet, up to about 13,000 feet, in very dense deciduous forests that have a bamboo understory. So they'll come down and they'll eat all the bamboo leaves. They're excellent climbers. They have semi-retractable claws, so they're designed to live in trees. When it's really, really cold, they use their nice fluffy tail to wrap around in front of their face, and they kind of roll up in a ball and just stay warm. At night, they generally will come down to the ground, and they'll feed on other things like mushrooms, flower blossoms. They'll find birds and bird eggs, maybe some mice. They are carnivores, although they largely eat plant material. 80% of their diet is bamboo leaves and other leaves. A single red panda can eat about 45% of their body weight per day in plant material.
Well, thank you so much. If I can get some interview questions from the people here.
Sure, my name is Becky. Last name is Sarsfield.
Okay, and have you ever seen a red panda before?
No, this is our first time. He is just so adorable. Reminds you of a raccoon. Markings and a long tail. I was a surprise with a long tail.
My name is Jordan Greer.
And what are your first impressions?
I think it's pretty rare. I'm from Philadelphia originally, and at the Philadelphia Zoo, there's a couple of red pandas, but they have like an inside habitat, so you don't ever get to see them. So this is like a big, wonderful moment. Like geeking out.
That was the Allegheny Front's Rachel Grace with panda keeper Ray Bamrick at the Pittsburgh Zoo. Rachel also spoke with some zoo visitors who actually admitted to skipping work to see the animal. Please go to our website for some super cute photos at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our program. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Janelle Pfeiffer is the production director, panda keeper, and our social media trailblazer. Please visit our website where you can now make donations to support our show at AlleghenyFront.org. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments, the Remmel Foundation, administered by PNC Charitable Trusts, the Laurel Foundation, and the A.D. and J.W. Wilson Fund of the Pittsburgh Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation and the Curtis and Edith Munson Foundation support coverage of Marcellus Shale issues.